5 UTC right after the internet.
Hello and welcome to Straight Talk Africa. I'm Vincent McCorry, filling in for Shaka Sali. Today, we'll look at major developments that impacted Africans in 2020, and that will set the pace for 2021. I'm joined by my guests, Emira Woods, a premier Pan-African strategist, and Kenneth Mwenda, law professor at the University of Pretoria in South Africa. Welcome to both of you.
It's a joy to be with you in the Straight Talk.
Thank you, Vincent. Pleasure.
Thank you. We're going to talk about a number of things that really characterized what happened on the continent of Africa and how they impacted the people of the continent of Africa. I wanted us to start with the coronavirus pandemic. To begin with, let me start with Emira Woods. Would you say that for the first time, because of coronavirus, Africa found itself on same level ground with the rest of the world for the first time?
Well, Vincent, we have to first say that our hearts go out to all those who have lost family members, have lost livelihoods. It's been a global pandemic that has had global implications, not only for the impact on people's lives, but also for the impact on economies and just on well-being, mental health. All of that has been affected across the globe. So I think for many of us, we see that, in fact, pandemics do not know borders. It is all regions of the planet that were affected, some more than others. We have seen particularly those of African descent, Black and brown people around the world, whether in the US or Europe or elsewhere, Brazil, it's Black and brown people, indigenous people that have been most affected. But we also see that, perhaps there's at least a bit of a hopeful sign. Some of us are a little anxious to even voice it, because we don't want to become complacent. But at the same time, we do know that the lessons of Ebola, from my own country, from other parts of the continent that were impacted by Ebola, the lessons of HIV/AIDS and the importance of changing social behavior, but also making sure that access is available for treatment. All of those lessons are coming to bear on the continent, and so we're cautiously optimistic that, even though we do see that the numbers are going up, that these lessons will place and have placed Africa in a better footing.
As Emira points out, some say that the lessons from HIV/AIDS became very useful to African countries. We're talking about Ebola, but some still worry that not true to some extent, because again, there were some countries in Africa where there was a level of denial. What is your take on how African countries responded to the fight against coronavirus?
Yeah, thanks, Vincent. Thankfully, Africa hasn't been as badly hit as part of the world in the Western Hemisphere. A number of reasons have been put forward by scholars and, think tanks. Largely, if you look at the population of Africa, it's generally a young population compared to the Western world. And also, this thing, when it all started, the pandemic, mainly coming from China to Western countries, it gave African countries an opportunity to prepare themselves. So they reacted in time to put measures to stop this. So we should give credit to a number of African countries for having taken those measures, closing borders quickly and so forth. So they learned from the experiences of other countries like Italy, for example, Spain, the UK and so forth. So that's a big plus for the African countries. You learn from others. The other issue also is the issue of climate, the weather conditions. There's been some arguments from scientists saying that, the virus cannot survive so much hot temperatures, sub-Saharan hot temperatures. So that has kind of played to the advantage of Africa. But all these sort of theories that are being put across by different scientists, you know, there's no definitive picture. But what we do know is that Africa has not been as badly hit as other parts of the world. But indeed, we can see that there are economic implications. And going into the post-COVID era, I think our prayer is that African governments should begin to prepare themselves for policies that will bring about job creation to, you know, to kickstart the economies, because definitely the economic meltdown will be felt due to the impact of COVID. We're looking at a middle class, growing the middle class. We need job creation, inclusive jobs. So those are some of the strategies I think that we should be focusing on, and, you know, priority areas of investment, especially in, concerning public expenditure.
Now, Emiro, would you say that the pandemic has exposed the vulnerabilities of African economies? We looked at the different sectors. For example, most countries are dependent on small-scale businesses, small-scale agriculture. And what happened is that with the pandemic and people being unable to conduct the small businesses, most people just were left without anything, without any source of income. So what lessons can Africans take from this, and what should happen in order to prepare the continent for any other similar situation?
Vincent, that's without a doubt, the economic implications are dramatic. And I think the biggest implication is that, you know, our economies have been based on this sort of dependence on imports and, extraction of resources, exporting those natural resources and importing everything else, including our food in many instances, right? So I think the market disruptions that have come as a result of this pandemic, you know, it has been devastating without a doubt for economies across the planet and especially on the continent. But perhaps the lesson there is that, you know, we've got to begin to shift our economies to meet our needs. So first and foremost, we've got to grow our own food, right? And stop depending on importing everything. We talk in West Africa about the jollof rice competitions. Who makes the best jollof rice? And then in many instances, we're importing even our rice, right? When our farmers are actually producing even more healthy grains of rice than anywhere on the planet. So we've got to be able to use the crisis as an opportunity to shift our economies to meet the needs of our people. Bottom line, I think it is critical to say that, you know, if we can focus on, you know, manufacturing, as you know, we always so well said, it's like, you know, it is the youth of the continent that is the blessing of the continent, and creating jobs where young people are able to get involved in manufacturing goods. Again, I'm from Liberia. We have rubber, but we ship that rubber to the U.S., right? Which is, you know, a pattern that started, you know, 8 decades ago and remains in place today. Why can we not, when the world needs rubber gloves to survive, why can we not manufacture those in our countries? So this is an opportunity to say, you know, the markets have been disrupted. The disruption can be a reset for our economies so that the economies actually meet the needs of the people for jobs, for food, for livelihoods that will actually address the incredible creativity and innovation of the continent.
Talking about resetting the economies, we're talking about a continent which most of the people are engaged in informal sector. The employment is provided by the informal sector, which was in some countries decimated by this pandemic. So how do you reset that? How do you move people from the informal sector to the formal sector and create an economy that is strong enough to survive any such a beating from a pandemic or whatever situation that may arise in the future?
Yeah, Vincent, a number of things come to play. Whenever there's a crisis, two things happen. there's fear and panic of loss of opportunity. On the other hand, a crisis can create opportunities for others. For example, digital disruption. Now we've seen universities, private universities offering courses, including public universities online, including here in the developed world. A lot of students are studying from home. We've seen opportunities of people, working remotely from home, telemarketing and so forth. Others are losing jobs. Others are getting jobs working remotely if you've got access to the digital platform. So, you know, you can grow entrepreneurship through these innovative means. Innovation is not just about new technology, it's about exploiting technology. So we need a mindset, a change of mindset to exploit opportunities, exploit the innovations that are coming into market. So there's scope for growth. Of course, industries such as tourism, for example, in Africa, is likely to be very much affected because of travel restrictions and so forth, and you know, social distancing and all those things. But we got to think creatively, like my sister Amira said. It's time to rethink the sort of abandoned policies of import substitution and export promotion. We have to go back and rethink the 1970s and how we're able to hold it together. That type of economic thinking is not old economics. It's still very much applicable in the modern age.
Yeah. And of course, it only helps if the leadership takes this lesson seriously and implements real serious programs. I want us to kind of touch a bit on the health structures and infrastructure in Africa. This was the first time where no elite could hop on a plane and go to Europe for treatment. Everybody was stuck in their own countries. And yet, we know the state of our health infrastructure. What did we learn? How did this perhaps in your assessment inspire, or did it inspire Africans to think again about setting up good health systems and conserve everybody? Amira.
You know, Vincent, it's the underlying question. You know, African governments decades ago made a commitment to spend 15% of their budget on health. And all have fallen far from that mark. We've got to invest in the human security. We see a lot of investment in, you know, quite frankly, you know, weapons of war, militarism, and all these things that destroy humanity. And I think we need to shift our mindset to really invest in human security. And it is through health systems that are public, that are available to everybody, that we will be able to withstand not only this pandemic, but future pandemics. I think we've got to also recognize, you know, along with a formal health infrastructure, it is women across the world who hold up issues around caregiving and have borne the greatest costs. Some are in healthcare, some are doing caregiving that is unpaid, right? And so I think we've got to also understand the need to lift up these caregivers to ensure that our base of care is supported, is strengthened, is paid, and appreciated. Because ultimately, you need both the public spending to bring the infrastructure into place, and you need the people power to make sure that infrastructure is available to all, whether they're in the most remote communities or they're in the urban centers.
Your take on the health infrastructure.
Thanks, Vincent. It's a governance issue primarily. Some of the resources that ought to be used to build our public health institutions and systems, for example, in Africa, we have issues of integrity risks, corruption, so to speak. So if we can sort of strengthen our governance systems, that would really help us to rechannel some of these resources which are going into pockets of private individuals. Corruption is a big challenge on the continent. We cannot shy away from that. And that in turn works against, you know, creating opportunities for growth of institutions and strengthening institutions in the public health sector. So that's a big challenge, I think, going forward. We do hope that, you know, we can pay much attention to governance issues across the continent.
And actually talk about governance and corruption. You know, it was so sad to observe that in a number of countries, money and resources that were set aside to fight the COVID-19 pandemic were stolen. In fact, in Kenya, there were people who have emerged now known as the COVID-19 billionaires. They stole money that was meant to help people, protect themselves from the pandemic. So what does that again tell us about our continent, taking advantage of a terrible, sad situation where people are dying to enrich oneself? So Emira, the governance issue, how loudly can anybody speak about that? Why do those things stay the same for years and years?
All right, Vincent, I'm calling in out of Washington, right? So this issue of accountability and transparency is not an Africa issue. Let's say that clearly right up front. And right now, you've got the biggest outliers right here in Washington, D.C. Can't ignore the governance questions, right? Those are ripe and they're key and they're important. You bring about governance by increasing opportunities for citizen oversight, by increasing opportunities for independent journalists and media to do exposés, by increasing a space for democracy to actually thrive. This is how you bring the accountability, the whole people accountable, to call them out when there are transgressions, and then to make sure that there is a judiciary that prosecutes and there's a full cycle of accountability. But I think we have to also pull back to understand that, it is also the international financial institutions, again, right here in Washington, D.C., the International Monetary Fund, it also has a role to play here, because for a large part, the policies of the international financial institutions have put a damper on public sector spending, including in healthcare. So if the IMF is saying in order to get loans, you must be able to follow these austerity measures that are basically saying don't pay your healthcare workers, keep their salaries low, right? You have this impediment towards the spending that would be needed for these public sector investments, because there is a push to privatize these services. There's an economic model that says if you have private clinics and hospitals, people will pay, people will make money, and that's the future. But we recognize that that cannot be a future that's viable, because it leaves out so many, not only on the African continent, but across the planet, who don't have access, who are not able to afford these kinds of...
Emira, with or without some of these adjustments that are required by the Bretton Woods institutions. What is saddening, I think, for some, is to see that for the African countries, as opposed, say, to a Western nation, those resources that are being stolen are actually already borrowed resources. Those are loans. Those are grants that are given out there. They would totally be decimated as soon as they arrive. And therefore, the excuse that it's because of the conditionalities that are being placed sometimes flies in the face of logic, when you know that whatever lands in these countries again gets stolen. Isn't that sad, though?
Well, it's a complex issue, but I think we've got to say that there's got to be a shift away from a notion that healthcare should be privatized to an understanding that health is a right. So it's a key. It's just a key framing of how we approach healthcare, not only in Africa, but around the world. If you say healthcare is a right, then you will have everyone from local officials to national, regional, international officials understanding that we've got to protect the right for everybody to have access. So that, it's a shift in how we, how we orient public sector services in order to protect those services. There will always be issues of graft around the world, right? This is what we're saying. Those issues will need private, independent scrutiny, right? People power, saying no and standing up and shedding, you know, light on what's happening to bring accountability. That's got to go hand in hand with making sure that we're also advancing a global infrastructure that prioritizes public essential services so that those services are available for all, whether it's for health or for education, or quite frankly, for energy.
I agree perfectly well with Amira. I mean, corruption is a global thing, okay? That's why we have corruption indexes done by various institutions. And even in Africa, we have a colleague from Sudan who runs the shop in London.
Mo Ibrahim, yes.
Yeah, you know. So it's a global phenomenon. However, the impact of corruption in a smaller economy, you know, is much different from the impact of corruption in a bigger economy like the US, for example, okay? And look at the institutions of governance, okay, where you have strong institutions, judiciary, who are not compromised by the executive of the state. Whereas in Africa, you have autocratic systems which can actually capture the state. And it's very difficult to fight corruption in those type of environments where you have an all-powerful executive that cuts across, you know? Developed countries, by contrast, yes, they have corruption, but they have relatively well-developed systems and institutions which can, you know, lead to better accountability if you pursue some of these individuals. Although not with absolute certainty, but there's a higher degree and higher probability.
Yeah. Okay. So I want us to turn to another issue in relation to COVID-19 pandemic, because it was a big thing on the continent before we talk about other matters, how it impacted the society. You know, think about customs and practices, you know, funerals, weddings, even, you know, happy moments and even sad moments. Amira, if I may start with you.
Oh, well, this has been the tragedy of our time, right? It's touched our lives in such profound ways. So many of us have lost family members and friends and have not had those traditional opportunities to grieve collectively. So I think it's been incredibly painful and incredibly difficult. And so we've got to understand the toll that this is taking on us as a human family, and be sure to provide as we move forward. Provide opportunities for psychosocial counseling, for caregiving, for all that's needed to kind of attend to those that will be long-term needs. I think I think many of us have learned to say goodbye on screens and without the intimacy of being there in the last moments of family members, and that leaves scars that are long-lasting. So I think we've got to recognize those scars, name them, and find ways to address them, both within our families and in our households, and within our health systems.
Indeed, it's been really sad. And Kenneth, just one word on that. Along with our inability to condole with our friends, to grieve, there was also even just the prolonged separation of families. Some of us have not seen our close family for a long time. And this had its toll, right?
Yeah, it definitely has had an impact on social ties and networks. In particular, if you look at the African, Asia, and Latin America setup, we are largely communitarian type of value systems around our families. We're not very individualistic. We like to hang out with our relatives and our cousins in large numbers. The Western world, the culture is a little bit different, of course, quite individualistic. But also you get the younger generation, the millennials who want to go to the beach during summertime. You can't stop them. You know, they want to have fun despite what's going on. Very energetic and that sort of thing. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's going to change drastically the way we work. A lot of us are now working remotely from home. My wife is a physician. She's a medical doctor. She works from home. We have clinicians who are also seeing patients online. The work environment has changed. The issue of shaking hands, even eating in restaurants on a dinner date, that thing is going to go for a while. It will take time before you can go out to dinner. at a nice restaurant. You know, you don't want to catch some of these diseases. So it's changed the way we do things, but more importantly, the way we work, the future of work. And Africa has to prepare for that. Yeah. ICT.
Yeah. It might take some time for people to get used to handshakes, hugs,
yes.
You know,
whatever. Or just using the elbow.
Exactly.
That's good enough.
I agree with all of that, especially all the issues around the future of work. I think the other issue is around women and the disproportionate impact on women. And I think you've had across, not just Africa, but across the world during this pandemic, increases in domestic violence, increases in gender-based violence. And so I think there's some real issues of pain and trauma that have resulted this year and that need to also be recognized and acknowledged as we move forward.
And actually, I wanted to come to that now. Briefly, at the back of my mind, I'm thinking about the education system. Perhaps we'll talk about that and how lack of technology has disadvantaged a number of other kids who are perhaps in the countryside as opposed to those in the cities. That has been, I think, another issue that countries have to think so much about in order to give people equal level of education. But talking about, if we may turn now to the issue you talked about social justice and violence. In fact, somewhere in the middle of the year, there were protests across the continent. We saw protests in Kenya, in Nigeria, in South Africa, and other countries for so many reasons. One was, of course, the violence against women, which increased quite a lot, and children. And, of course, there were also charges of excessive force from security apparatus in many countries. So perhaps, Emira, you want to touch on that, and then we can have Kenneth also give us his take.
Oh, well, I feel like the joy of this year has been that this is a year of movements. And I think we all watched as, the horrific killing of George Floyd unfolded before our eyes. But what it ignited was a movement for justice for Black lives around the world. And to see protests from South Africa to Europe, throughout the world, what has come forward, I think, is an incredible just dynamism. And at the center, at the core, you have these brilliant young leaders. Brilliant young people. You know, I'm always touched when I think that the video of George Floyd would not have come to the world's eye without the poise and, you know, of this 17-year-old young woman who held that camera, held that phone to make sure that the world's gaze would not turn away. 17 years old, right? And you had also NSARS in Nigeria, young woman holding the camera to the atrocities going on and making sure that the world does not turn away. So there is something about this moment and young people using tools of creativity to demand justice that I think has been profound and will have, you know, repercussions for not just decades, but for centuries to come. I think we are at a moment of global reckoning on race because of these young leaders and what they have done. And so I think it's been incredibly difficult, right? I mean, there are countries where you've had a real clampdown by security forces in the name of COVID, right? And lockdowns and all, right? So there's a lot of really nasty violations of human rights. But there is also this dynamism of young people, this power of movements that has it's really been inspiring. And yes. It's been global. So I want to also, I didn't mention the Africans Rising, you know, champions that actually scaled the British Parliament to hang a banner saying rewrite history, demanding, you know, reparations and justice, right? So it is the bold thinking of people saying, okay, we can't gather in the way that we may have before, but what else can we do? And they're pushing those boundaries. And I think there will be more of that to come because of these creative young leaders.
You're watching Straight Talk Africa. We'll be right back.
health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living.